Good morning. Great to be back with you once again for part four. There really isn't any church history after where we're going. We're going to be making it after this. But I'd like to do what I did last time. I need a volunteer to pass out chocolates. We're going to do something that I started when I was lecturing at Fosen, which Peter informed me he got the whole kilogram of chocolate that I instituted as the whole semester-long competition. But we're smaller scale today, I'm afraid. You've only got two questions. So could I have a volunteer chocolate passer outer, please, while we get the... Oh, thank you, Paul. Okay. All right. And while we're getting the projector to behave itself... If any of you want to explore any of the issues in church history, I've just got a small book here that you can pick up if you want to. We sell them this morning for $7, which is cheaper than Coorong's got them, but it's written as an email conversation between a jaundiced student and a church history lecturer. So this morning, if you want one, $7. If you don't have $7 and you want one, take one anyway. Okay, I'll put them over there at the end. Okay. All right, well, it's on the screen, but it's just not quite on that screen. So we have liftoff. It's just warming up, is it? Fantastic. Okay. So we need to change the oil and the filter, I think. Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. All right. Well, the screen will catch up with this. Oh, it has. Fantastic. Okay, so we're in the modern church period, and here's our first question. Multiple choice. So what you have to do, you get A, B, C, or D, and you just have to remember your choice and then obviously be honest. This is not the place to be dishonest, okay? All right? So I'm placing temptation in front of you at the moment. Am I going to be honest? So the question is, who described pain as, quote, God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world? Was that... A, Thomas à Kempis, B, C.S. Lewis, C, Philip Yancey, or D, Max Lucado? So you don't call them out. Think it, lock it in, okay? And the second question is, what argument for the existence of God was advanced by William Paley in 1802? Was it A, if there is a watch, there must be a watchmaker. B, if there is an egg, there must be an egg beater. C, if there is an egg, there must be a hen. Or D, if there is a digestive system, food must exist. Okay, so have you locked your two letters in? You all right? You've got them locked in? All right, so just go back a bit and we'll... So the right answer for question one was, in fact, B, C.S. Lewis. And the right answer for question two, I'd like to say C, but it's actually A. If there's a watch, there must be a watchmaker. So how many people got two? Ooh, okay, that's what, roughly about 15. All right, we'd better stick with, I think... What the... Okay, all right, if you got two, leave your hand up and you'll get two chocolates. Okay. So that option A was called argument by design. Okay, while we're handing out chocolates and nobody is paying any attention to me, I'll quickly go through the next couple of slides, which are a little bit of a recap. So we've said previously there are... normally look at four main periods of church history, and those dates are not really chosen at random, they're chosen because there were significant changes in worldview happening around those particular times. So when we were together last, we looked at Reformation church history, the period up until 1650. So now we're in this last one, modern church history. And we find that there are a couple of perennial questions that are always asked, and often around these changes in period, those four periods, people will start answering these key questions in different ways. What is the church, and where or what or who is the authority?
You didn't bring it out chocolates.
Didn't I? Oh, no. I've got disgruntled crowd. Okay. All right.
Who is that?
I didn't
get anything right.
Okay. All right. Now, this was the last slide we finished with last time, so this should may ring a bell. So I'm just quickly going to put these points up again. Having got to the end of the Reformation era, we're looking at some key things that start to set the tone for the modern era in the West. Monarchs were no longer unchallenged. We've executed Charles I. Kings can be guilty of treason. The scripture is being proposed as a new authority. We've moved on from the authority of kings and monarchs and empires and governments. We're also moving on from the authority of the Roman Catholic Church as being unquestioned. Therefore, you can defy popes and bishops. That's okay. Individuals coming increasingly into the spotlight. And there's a whole massive war, 30 years war, that ends with something called the Treaty of Westphalia, which means that people are grudgingly accepting they have to live side by side with people whose religious opinions are very different from their own, which also really means that this church-state alliance that had been around really since the time of Constantine is something that is really now effectively dead, although it will take a long time to work that through. Okay, so as we move through into the second part of the 17th century, moving towards 1700, we start to move towards something a lot of you would have heard of, called the Enlightenment. And we move on from having done these initial challenges of government and church authority, we start to be on a bit of a roll. People are starting to question all sorts of authorities, and really the next authority people start to question is the authority of Scripture itself. And as we get to around 1700, the Enlightenment, or this movement that says where we really put our confidence is in the power of human reason. So how do we know what's true? How do we know what to believe in? Do we just accept it from an authority? No, that's no longer the tenor of the times. Increasingly, human reason is seen as the pathway to that sort of certainty. And there is still a confidence around that there is that sort of certainty. So reason becomes the measure of all things. This is, you know, rationalism is where this came in. And what that means is things that are deemed to be unreasonable are seen to be held very lightly and perhaps completely discarded. So the new authority increasingly is what I think is reasonable. So it becomes a lot more of a self-focus, if you like. One of the very positive things to come out of this that we've all benefited from is the rise of science. And later on, the Industrial Revolution, etc. But science, as you'd all know, is really based on what is observable and what is repeatable. And certain things don't fit into that mould very comfortably. Religious issues don't. Emotional issues don't, for example. But as increasingly this Enlightenment affects society and culture in the West, it also naturally then affects what you think of God. Who's God? What's God like? And we get something emerging called deism, which really means that this age of reason, we might think that immediately the age of reason arrived, people started completely dismissing the idea of God and becoming atheists. That really wasn't the case. Most of these early scientists were people of faith, and they were gradually trying to bring together the two ideas. But what happened is that God started to be seen as the God of reason, because reason was the big issue. Reason was the canon, if you like, the measure by which they were establishing things. So God eventually becomes a bit different, perhaps, than the God we see in the Bible. We use that in the questions, that argument by design, if you like, that argument of because the universe exists because the watch exists, there must be a watchmaker. Because creation exists, there must be a creator, sort of thing. But what sort of creator? So the God that emerges here is, yes, he's creator or powerful, but remote. In other words, winds up the clock, the universe, puts it in position, sets it running, and disappears to a distant galaxy and sits on the Milky Way drinking a pina colada after, you know, well-deserved rest here. And so it's a reasonable universe. It's been set in place by a reasonable God. And what are we doing? We're following God's footsteps after him, using our reason to discover the principles that are inherent in creation. That's our job. But if God's remote, if he doesn't bother that much about us, why should we bother that much about him? We might acknowledge he's there, sort of tip our hat to God, if you like. But really, if he's remote, then there's no real relationship there. So why not put our focus on this world, on this life? And that tends to be what happens. And so worldly happiness becomes at a premium. During this time then, one of the things that happens is that the church tends to be seen, and this shows up in a very real way in the French Revolution, for example. The church, and there's a lot of truth behind it, is seen as a source of repression. They're allied, particularly in France at this time, with the rich and powerful. They had a callous attitude towards the economic difficulties that the French people were going through. And so when the French Revolution gets underway, the clergy are executed alongside the nobles. They establish these rights of man, basic human rights, etc. Now, the idea of a remote God filters right through everything in the church. It filters through preaching. There's one of the quiz questions that I talk about. There's an example of a sermon from Germany. Now, you know, Germany was where, you know, the Reformation gets underway, Martin Luther, you know, passionate belief, justification by faith, all that stuff we were talking about last time. But not that long after Luther dies and the Enlightenment hits and we've got a remote God, you might turn up on a Sunday and you'd hear a sermon about, they'd take it from some psalm about hair, and it would be on the Christian attitude to hair and the appropriate way to use your hair if you're a Christian, do your hair, and Christian attitudes to the hair through history. For some reason, people found this didn't really set their hearts on fire and lead them to a deeper relationship with God. So history is sometimes a bit like a metronome. You move to one direction and then you get a strong reaction in the other direction. And one reaction against what was perceived as some of the dryness associated with rationalism and the Enlightenment was something called pietism. And pietism is really a response that says what we want is a religion of the heart. We want it to be biblical, we want it to be devotional. Small groups came out of this pietist movement, Bible reading groups, missionary groups. But they had a flaw. Pietists, being a metronome reaction against rationalism, said that we look at this rationalistic stuff. The problem with it is that people are too intellectual. And one of the key guys associated with this, a guy called Count von Zinzendorf, said, the man who seeks to understand God with his mind becomes an atheist. So it was a very strong reaction against the life of the mind. Pietism leads into a number of other things. We'll talk briefly about John Wesley, certainly leads into that. But it also, I think, leads into the anti-intellectual aspect of fundamentalism that's with us. So Pietists made a very positive contribution, but not theologically, for obvious reasons. Conversion comes to be emphasised under them. We talked about Puritans last time. Laity role is definitely there. And they are busy, as we've said, really discarding the intellect. So as we move into the 18th century, one of the things that happens on both sides of the Atlantic is we have evangelical awakenings. In America, these happen linked with guys called Jonathan Edwards, George Whitfield. These are times when you have itinerant ministers. These guys are both, Whitfield's on both sides of the Atlantic, but here in this context, particularly we're talking about America. So you can imagine America in the, say, 1730s, 1740s. It's still, you know, largely developing, moving westward from that eastern initial settlement. And this is the time when we start to see open-air evangelism. George Whitfield, who, anyone heard of Benjamin Franklin? George Whitfield was good friends with Benjamin Franklin. And they've estimated that at George Whitfield's final sermon in 1740 the east of the US, and Whitfield made about 8 trips across the Atlantic, which was a significant thing to do in the middle of the 18th century. So he was sort of one of the first transatlantic ministers, really. Benjamin Franklin, who remained unconvinced by Whitfield's Christian arguments, really, estimated that at his final sermon on Boston Common in 1740, 20,000 people could hear him without amplification. Now, that's not a bad voice, you know. Some of you, I know, musicians, wouldn't be bad to be able to do that, would it? But this was a time when people were called to recognise the gulf between them in their sinfulness and a holy God. It's something coming out of the Reformation. People were starting to process the idea that maybe this, it's not an automatic regeneration in baptism. Maybe there is something about this faith response. Maybe I do have to think about where I am in my relationship with God. That's what Jonathan Edwards looked like. Okay. And Whitfield, as we said, was a link both sides of the Atlantic. Now, you may never have heard of George Whitfield, but if you've ever heard a sermon that you like, you probably owe him a debt of thanks. So, for example, Whitfield would often preach without notes. He would often look at the congregation. Now, that might strike you as odd that I'd even mention that, but before the time of Whitfield, what was quite normal was that you would completely write your sermon out in longhand, and you would read it from your notes, not making much eye contact with the audience, and you would not use humour, you would not use drama, you would not change the tone of your voice. Whitfield had a background on the stage. One of the biographies of him is called The Divine Dramatist. One of the great actors of the day, Shakespearean actors of the day, said, "I'd give 1,000 guineas," which was a lot of money, "if I could just say Mesopotamia like George Whitfield." Okay, I'm not sure how much Mesopotamia got into his sermons, but anyway. But he introduced all of those things into modern preaching that I've just implied. He would change the pronouns from, say, third person to first and second person. So in other words, instead of saying "the man who sins is lost," he'd say something like "you who sin are lost." Had an impact. Okay, I think I've got ahead of myself there. All right. And personal decision was in the foreground of all of these. These people were preaching for transformation. They're preaching for conversion. Okay, and that's what he looked like. All right, so he had an influence on John Wesley, who is over in the UK side of things. Wesley was converted to open air preaching through Whitfield's influence. Open air preaching might not strike us as particularly revolutionary, but back then it was. You know, the only appropriate place to preach was in a church. much as in earlier times, the only appropriate place to pray was in a church. You know, that's where God was. And there's a particularly poignant illustration when Wesley started preaching the idea of regeneration, the idea of the new birth, and therefore that wasn't particularly welcome in Anglican churches. He was denied access to churches to preach. And they said the only place you're allowed to preach is on land that you own. Well, the only land he could really claim to own was his father's grave. So he stood on his father's grave and preached. Eventually, he moved out following Whitfield's instigation, and they were preaching to the masses outside in England. Wesley's ministry went through much of the 18th century. So you've got a series of awakenings happening in America, starting with Edwards and Whitfield, and you've got a series of awakenings also happening in England, particularly under Wesley and the Methodists. Wesley stays an Anglican minister all his life, but increasingly what becomes the Methodist Church becomes more and more independent and more at tension with the Anglican Church as it goes on. Particularly over this issue of conversion. Methodism ultimately splits into Calvinist and Arminian groups, and many of you I know would know those terms. If you don't, essentially, there's a different, at the heart of it is a different view of where the salvific process starts. Does it start with God's movement and God's choice? Does it start with our movement and our choice? And also during the Wesleyan revivals, there were many unusual manifestations, some of which might be more associated, say, with Pentecostalism today. And there's Wesley. Okay, so coming through this 1700s, 18th century, we start to see this term coming up called evangelicalism. Again, I know many of you are familiar with this term. What is it? Obviously, very similar to the word evangelism, leads to some confusion often. And there's various definitions, but one that's gained a lot of currency is a guy by the name of David Bebbington's definition. And he's hit four things here. Conversionist, activist, biblicist, and very ugly word, really, crucicentrist. Okay, so it's all about, if you have an emphasis on conversion, if you're highly active in expressing that, if your focus of authority is on the Bible, and if your focus is on the cross, on the crucifixion of Christ, that's a fourfold definition that's gained a lot of currency. In contrast to other Christian groups that may have these other emphases, sacramental, contemplative, etc. Okay, we hit the Industrial Revolution, partly because we've become so clever with all the science we've discovered because of the Enlightenment. And one of the things that happens is great social change, as you probably all know from one of the few things I remember, I think, from studying history in high school, is the social dislocation, etc., that was caused by the Industrial Revolution. So you have cities growing, the population in the country declining. You have, if you've ever read anything by Dickens or seen any of the movies of Dickens novels, you can go to that spot pretty much straight away. The slavery, the child labour was all there. And we also start getting into this era, particularly once we get into the 19th century. One historian has written his volume in a multi-volume work on the 19th century, and it's called The Crowded Century. So much was going on. It was certainly in terms of international relations, the spread of empires, the British Empire, colonisation, etc. One of the fascinating things, and I have to restrain myself here because I've done a bit of study touching on this area, Romanticism comes in those are the, sort of the official dates of it. It's partly a response to rationalism, which it saw as reductionistic. And we tend not to be as familiar with Romanticism, I think, as we are with rationalism. But one scholar, a guy by the name of Irving Berlin, has said that of all the movements of thought in the last 200 years that have affected the West, he thinks Romanticism is the most profound. And you can draw and we're not going to explore this today. Maybe we can talk about it afterwards. But you can draw fairly much a straight line from romanticism through existentialism to postmodernism. So if you're interested in either of those last two words, existentialism and postmodernism, then you're also, by implication, interested in this, which in its own way backtracks to some of the pietist thought as well. But romantics were comfortable with things, as you can see in the last couple of lines, that people who were emphasising rationalism weren't comfortable with or didn't perhaps fit their system as neatly. So people had come to the point of view of saying, well, hang on, love. How rational is love? Love is part of a core part of who we are as human beings. But show it to me in a laboratory. You go, right, okay, slight problem. And we all know that there are things out there that are mysterious, that are bigger than we are. Romantics were comfortable with that. People who emphasised the rational tended not to be, because mysteries were there to be solved, and if it wasn't immediately solvable, we had to solve it as quickly as possible. Otherwise, we weren't completely comfortable with that. And this is a movement that cuts across all aspects of culture and society in the West. So it affects poetry. Many of you would have studied the Romantic poets in school, you know, Coleridge and Keats and Shelley and those guys. It affects music, it affects art, etc. So it's a significant movement. And one of the things that comes to be seen increasingly is the difficulty with objectivity. A lot of rationalism was built on objectivity, the fact that I can sit outside things and observe them without impinging on them. I'm somehow a neutral observer. Increasingly, romanticism highlighted that that's really not possible. By observing, we are involved in what's going on. And one of the things that comes out of this is even more a value on individual perception. So just because my perception is different from yours doesn't mean that mine is wrong. Individual perception is then at a premium. And therefore, diversity is seen as less of a problem because of that. In previous eras, and if you remember right back to some of the things we said in the early church lecture, diversity was a problem back there. They needed unanimity. Okay, into our crowded century, and I'm going to speed up a bit. We've got guys like, Keats. Ode to a Grecian Urn. The final couplet in that is something like, truth is beauty, beauty truth, that is all you know in life and all you need to know. So there's an equation of truth and beauty there. Therefore, if beauty is subjective, and the saying we all know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, ... You can fill that in. Maybe truth is in the eye of the beholder, and truth is subjective. So we can see here the beginnings in the early part of the 19th century of some thoughts we're very familiar with. Okay, we also have Marxist socialism, which puts, I won't say, I've overstated the case here. Not everything is explained by economics, but you know, it's central. Darwinism comes up with its own idea of how things are explained. Freud comes up with his idea of how everything is explained. And not only because of the whole empire thing, colonisation thing, it means the West is also encountering this very bewildering variety of cultures and religions as all that expands. A couple of photos. Okay. Now, the church responds to all of this activity, intellectual activity, cultural activity in various ways. In the US, evangelicalism makes huge gains, and they get involved very often in social issues, including the slavery issue, obviously on both sides of the Atlantic. Liberal theology is also influenced in a reinterpretation of some of Christian orthodoxy comes through from Romanticism. And the Roman Catholic Church has its own distinct response to this in Vatican I, and it basically says, this is in the middle of the 19th century, says basically to go away to the modern world. The Roman Catholic Church refused really to engage quite formally with some of these ideas that were coming through. Okay, missionary outreach we've mentioned. A guy called William Carey really gets... The Roman Catholics got off to a much earlier start, really, in international missions than the Protestants did. Carey kicks things along and the Protestants enter the field seriously. But then there's this tension, often failing to distinguish between culture and Christianity. In other words, if we're bringing the Christian gospel, we need to make people into what little Westerners, you know, because that's part of the parcel. Very briefly, Australia. Interestingly, you could 160 capital crimes. You could be hanged for 160 things in England in the 18th century, including such strange things as malicious wounding of cattle, stealing linen from bleaching grounds, or stealing, and I think they use the term stealing rather than kidnapping, an heiress. So it's okay to steal a girl with no money, you know, but if you steal a girl with money, now that will kill you for, you know. And malicious maiming of cattle, I guess the malicious bit lets butchers off the hook. Excuse the pun. Okay. First fleet arrives with one of my ancestors in 1788. Overload of far more men than women. And we're talking about this earlier, about the Catholic side of things. First chaplain was obviously an Anglican because all this was coming from England. And even though a lot of the convicts were Catholics, they weren't looked after initially. Lots of them keep arriving for the next 80 years. Oh, there's your demographic. One of my convict ancestors came out at the under the age of 15. So much younger than average there. And a very interesting story behind this guy, Jeremiah O'Flynn, which I won't really have time to go into now, but he was the first Catholic chaplain. And he was sent out here. He basically used it as a reason to get out of being disciplined because he'd been dismissed from his first post in the Caribbean somewhere on charges being, quote, flagrantly insubordinate. And so he's sitting in the halls in Rome waiting to be disciplined for this. And when he hears they need someone in Australia, he says, send me. And it's a very colourful story from then on. Okay, we've got Pentecostalism beginning in America. Starts in with a guy called Charles Parham, Topeka, Kansas, and William Seymour, who moves out to Los Angeles, and something called the Azusa Street Revival in 1906 begins. This is a 8 or 9 year period of revival where people, it's a bit like spiritual tourism. A lot of people come to Azusa Street, see what's going on, go back to their individual towns and countries and take something of the spirit of that revival with them. There's a couple of controversies which I won't go into now for the sake of time. And formally as a denomination, the Assemblies of God starts just as World War I is also starting. That's a picture of the building where it really all kicked off. And I'm going to, for the sake of time, have to kick through the next few slides very, very quickly. In the 1959-60, the charismatic movement begins. So this is basically an openness to various gifts of the Spirit, similar to the Pentecostal movement, but starting within established and more traditional denominations. The usual response happens. A guy called Dennis Bennett was a key figure, and that it got splattered across both Time and Newsweek magazine, and that made it a national issue. He got kicked out of his church, started another one, but those two articles had put it into a national context. And eventually, much to the shock of the Pentecostals, all other denominations start to act in similar ways in a province that they thought was really theirs, and I think they got a real shock when this happened in the Roman Catholic Church, because these guys were still talking too much about Mary for a start. Okay. All right. Now, final slide. All right. So the 1960s, as many of you would know from a whole range of issues, a fascinating decade of cultural change. The often seen as the end of World War II is often seen as the end of modernism, and so we start flirting with this term postmodernism. But this whole thing of spirituality gets opened up and people are looking at it and open to it in various ways. You know, get the Jesus people, New Age, Eastern religions, etc. You know, I've got a book somewhere in my bookshelf by a guy, written I think in 1954, by a guy called Pennethorne Hughes, and the title of the book is Witchcraft. And in the preface of this book, he's saying, sort of poo-pooing the idea, oh, no one in the modern world believes in witches, no one believes in witchcraft, ho, ho, ho. And yet, you know, you can walk into any newsagent now and see three or four magazines on, you know, how to become a witch. So something changed between the 1950s and the 60s. People opened up to all sorts of spiritual activity. And it no longer was something necessarily that was despised in a general sense. All of this is happening at the same time as the Catholic Church has Vatican II, which was a very different spirit from Vatican I, and opened up much more to non-Catholics. And what we've drawn from through Romanticism, existentialism, etc., is an aversion in the modern world, postmodern world, to overarching truth claims. And that, I think, still remains with us. Okay, so what next? Well, something that hasn't changed for a long time, really. Politics and religion always seem to be together and often on the front page. A lot of people have noticed that this age we're living in now is more similar in many ways to the early church age than it was to the intervening two periods of the medieval church and the Reformation church, because we're now really in a parallel time of great religious diversity. All the religious options are out there. You don't just have one dominant player on the scene, as it were. We have to deal with this issue of tolerance. Author Don Carson has written an interesting book called The Intolerance of Tolerance. So is what passes for tolerance today actually intolerant, because you know, there are certain things that it won't approach. So for example, if you talk about any possible existence of absolutes today, that's seen as something that you can't really sensibly discuss, because if you excuse me being a bit facetious for a minute, the one thing we're absolutely sure of is that there are no absolutes today. And we're in the situation of, you know, do cultural sensitivities today demand that we reduce Jesus Christ to just one of many ways to God? Okay, that's the final slide. Just finished with one quick comment. One writer, Roman Catholic writer called Avery Dulles, a number of years ago, wrote a book on images of the church. And one of those images of the church was that the church was a sacrament. Not that the church performed sacraments, the church itself is a sacrament. In other words, the very existence of the church is a sign of the grace of God at work. And having spent a lot of years looking at church history from different angles, having seen the litany of sin and faithlessness and error and human frailty, to me, the existence of the church is just that, in its various forms. It is a sacrament. The church is a sacrament. It's a sign. It's just its existence is a sign of the grace of God at work in the world. And we've got a privilege of being part of that next page. Thanks.